Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. Today's podcast is about the EU Green Deal and its efforts to promote decarbonization all around the world. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am joined today by Bruegel Simone Tagliapietra, Jacob Werksman, a principal advisor on these issues at the European Commission, and Bruegel Cecilia Trazzi. Simone and Cecilia and colleagues have a new paper out on some of the ways the EU can do this and ways to make it go better. Jacob is helping the EU get ready for COP, the big climate change conference in November of this year. And they are going to tell you all about how this fits into the broader Green Deal and where we're going with that. Simone, can you help us figure out where we stand and what you want people to learn today?
Thank you, Rebecca. So let me start maybe by saying something about the European Green Deal and where we are with this transformative project. So the European Green Deal was launched in 2019 by President Ursula von der Leyen as the flagship initiative for her European Commission presidency. Over the last 5 years, what we have seen under the European Green Deal, I would say, has been a wave of legislation, of regulation, but also additional EU funding to steer implementation at the European level of our climate policy objectives, which have become way more ambitious in the meantime. So with the European Green Deal, with the climate law in particular, we have enshrined into legislation the objective of reaching net zero emissions by 2050 and increase our ambition when it comes to the emissions reductions, 55% emissions reduction by 2030 is the target vis-a-vis 1990 levels. To get there, there have been many initiatives underpinned, starting, for example, with the tightening of our carbon market, the Emission Trading System, ETS, but also the creation of a new ETS covering sectors that were not previously covered, such as buildings and road transport, which represent an important share of our greenhouse gas emissions. Now, with this paper, we are taking an external dimension view on the Green Deal. So the Green Deal so far has predominantly been developed as a domestic agenda because that's what Europe needs to do, to put the house in order, to clean it up, to slash our domestic emissions. But of course, the international repercussions of the Green Deal are important and will increasingly be important in the coming years for a number of reasons. Let me start with one. First of all, Europe is 7% of global emissions today. So if Europe wants to foster global decarbonization, it needs to move, of course, beyond its borders. Leading by example is what is requested to a continent like Europe, which has an important role in terms of historical emissions. Let's remember that. But that's not sufficient. That's a sort of bare minimum. We need to create alliances to foster international collaborations so to make sure that other countries around the world also move in the decarbonization trajectory we need to remain under the goals of the Paris Agreement. And then there is another element which I think it's important, which is that what happens in the EU doesn't stay in the EU. The EU is a very large economy. And if we apply certain regulations in our domestic market or we regulate our imports by taking into consideration some environmental dimensions, of course, that has impact on our trade partners. So measures we have been adopting under the European Green Deal, starting with the famous carbon border adjustment measure or others like the, for example, EU deforestation law, will unavoidably impact significantly our trade partners as these measures will enter into force. This means that the European Green Deal must be as much as a foreign policy initiative as it is a domestic policy initiative. And then let me conclude by saying that there are other two elements which in the next 5 years will, in our view, make the external dimension of the European Green Deal even more important than before. And this is really related to the new strategic priorities of the Union. being competitiveness on the one hand and strategic autonomy on the other. This is the discussion related to the need to diversify our supply chains, namely to reduce our dependence on China for critical raw materials, clean technologies, and we know the importance for this when it comes to trade measures, to our competition policy, our single market, etc. And also, of course, with regard to the economic security dimension, which predominantly goes through, in this space, the creation of partnerships with third countries to create new value chains, new supply chains, namely when it comes to critical raw materials. So these new strategic priorities implies that our external action on the Green Deal will become possibly even more important over the next 5 years than it was previously. And that's why we think a greater action will be needed in this space. A greater action will be required to increase Europe's global green reach as we move forward.
And very briefly to set the scene, what are your top couple of recommendations? What are the areas that you want the EU to act in?
Well, we will come to that, of course, later in detail. But in a nutshell, what we see as a key action to be undertaken moving forward is an attempt to streamline our action in the world. We have, for example, put in place at the EU level a number of different partnerships with different third countries, energy partnerships, critical raw materials partnerships, green partnerships. We have a lot of activities going on. And of course, this kind of fragmentation is understandable from an administrative perspective as well to get things done. But we think that streamlining and possibly getting into more comprehensive, unique green partnership that cover the different pieces of the mosaic could be the best way to move forward with selected major trade partners in order to really have a more integrated action in this space. Another element is to better assess, for example, the real impact of EU climate finance. Climate finance is a cornerstone of the Paris Agreement and the principle of common but differentiated responsibility. Europe is the first provider of climate finance in the world, but maybe there is space to make our climate finance more impactful and really to make sure that our public resources allocated to these are really up to the challenge of mobilizing those private investments we need to scale up mitigation and adaptation projects in the global south. And then there is also, I think, something to say about the EU governance to manage all of this, but maybe we will come to that later.
We will, and thank you for that. It shows what a transformative moment we're in, where the EU is no longer inventing new things. It's now trying to make all of the things it has wrought work together and work out in the world. Jacob, how do you distill this into something that the EU can take to these global conferences and fit into the global diplomacy?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me and for the opportunity to look at the research and the thinking that you've been doing. It's obviously a critical moment. We have just been through the process of European elections. We have a new parliament, and we are now in the process of appointing a new commission. All signs are at the moment that we will have stability in leadership as we move into the next 5 years. And therefore, the real focus of the commission will be on two tracks. One is a near-term, middle-term track, which is really bedding down the commitments and the policies and the regulations that Simona just described. In doing so, focusing on implementation and really working through all the elements of these innovations in policy, the expansion of the ETS, the putting in place of new incentives with regard to trade-related climate policies. The second track is beginning to think beyond that, because as was mentioned, we've made a commitment to be net zero by 2050. That is embedded in our climate law, which is legally binding on the EU. But it's also a reflection of our commitment to the Paris Agreement, which requires us and the rest of the international community to be net zero by 2050, and to demonstrate that we're on the pathway to that by coming forward with a new nationally determined contribution under the Paris Agreement, which is essentially our next target. The set of policies that was just described is under the framework of what we call the Fit for 55 package. So that's the policies that we put in place to meet our current commitment of ensuring that our emissions are 55% below 1990 levels by 2030. And that is our NDC, our nationally determined contribution under the Paris Agreement. But the Paris Agreement requires us to come up with our next target already by the end of next year, or as early as possible in 2025. And that will set and describe the pathway over the longer term of 2035, 2040. So it's both the near-term challenge of implementation, but also the long-term visioning of what that further pathway looks like that's absolutely critical. In terms of the external dimension of that, I think that it's still a very dynamic space. In theory, the rest of the international community should be moving at a similar pace that the EU has committed itself to. Following that principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, we still expect countries like the EU, regions like the EU, the United States, the other industrialized countries to be net zero by 2050 and the others to be not too far behind, with the major emitters whose emissions have grown so much since the 1990s to show leadership as well. But they will be traveling along different pathways. There will be different levels of ambition. And that's what raises the need for a very sophisticated external policy that creates the right set of incentives and disincentives for making sure that we're not just leading by example, but our example is actually being followed in one way or another. How the incoming commission will frame that challenge, I think, is still something to be seen. I think there's going to be a lot of thinking in the next couple of months as to how we brand it. I heard the words strategic autonomy used to describe that. To me, this is not something that might sell well domestically because it suggests that we are smart and therefore acting strategically. And by autonomous, I suppose it suggests that we have a sense of free will, that we're not just being shaped by the world around us, but we're actively shaping it and we're looking after our interests in that context. But of course, your partners don't want to be seen as being separated from what it is that the EU is doing. And I think as a matter of describing the world as we find it, the EU does have and will continue to have an open market economy and will be, I think, increasingly interconnected with the fate of our trading partners, our rivals, and the rest of the world. So I don't think autonomy quite captures the direction that we'll be going, but it is a much more sophisticated set of partnerships that we will be looking towards. And I think those partnerships will depend upon a common objective, that objective of getting to net zero by the middle of the century, by avoiding dangerous climate change, that we have to presume is the shared objective of major economies and our major trading partners. But it will also be one in which everyone is seeking to benefit from that transition and not to be excluded from it. And that means that as we pursue our own initiatives domestically, we have to make sure that we're strengthening and deepening our partnerships with our allies, as well as those that we are, as I said, increasingly interdependent upon as well.
Cecilia, how do you see these challenges working in an environment where you have the EU trying to redefine its trade relationship with China, which has a very different approach on these issues? You have the EU trying to redefine its relationship with the US, which is having its own identity crisis about how it's going to handle the transition and its industrial transition, and the developing world, which doesn't have the resources to be at the same level in terms of new technologies and economic cushion, and also may be bearing the brunt of some of these border costs as the carbon price starts to come in the EU and elsewhere. How do you see this?
Thank you, Rebecca. What you just pointed out is probably one of the biggest challenges, exactly as my colleagues have just presented. The past 2 years have shown how the path to decarbonization is, of course, marred by the barriers of, you know, threat to competitiveness and economic security, as Jack was just saying, because we saw, as you mentioned, the US is going alone, is having its own existential crisis. But most importantly for us, 2 years ago, it came out with the Inflation Reduction Act, which in a way shown the commitment towards climate action, but also clearly signaled the fact that it's willing to go alone if needed. At the same time, China clearly is using its own predominance in clean technologies, but also its own clout and influence in third countries, making sure to have access through these four countries to the critical materials and the energy resources it needs to push for its own economic development and decarbonization. At the same time, in these past 2 years, what also became very clear with the war in Ukraine was that the EU should pursue as much as possible on one side strategic autonomy, which, okay, it's a buzzword, but it essentially means that it can avoid relying on one country only for the access to resources, and should, you know, diversify as much as possible the supply for these resources. But at the same time, it also should push for, let's say, cooperation with countries that are closer or like friendlier. And this is a bit of a challenge. Why? Because at the same time, we have the role of the EU on the world stage has been, let's say, shrinking a bit. The influence of the EU, at least, or the predominance of the EU in the face of the US or China has definitely become more limited over time, at least diplomatically, because economically it still plays a major role, but then at least diplomatically, it's less clear where the countries stand. There is increased skepticism and more backlash in third countries too, in reaction to the implementation of domestic policies. For example, you mentioned the carbon pricing. With CBAM, we could clearly see that there is a mounting concern in third countries to what will it mean for them. So, of course, it's obvious that countries that export a lot of the goods that are being touched by CBAM are going to be directly affected. But truth, we have developing countries like, for example, Mozambique, who rely way more on exports of, for example, steel to fuel their own economies. They feel like they're kind of left out. Why? Because probably there is not, on one side, a clear communication of what CBAM really is going to mean for them, but also probably not the best synergy between what is essentially a trade and environmental, or let's say, climate policy instrument and development policy instrument. So the challenge really is how to coordinate this in a context that is way more tense, that is pushing more to the test the, let's say, benevolence of Europe in third countries, I would say.
Thank you for that. In the next part of our podcast, we'll talk more about the money and how that plays into all of this. Simone, you mentioned climate finance. What scale is the EU able to start putting climate finance into the world? And on what scale are the total Green Deal commitments going to come in at?
Thank you, Rebecca. As you know, developed countries manage to let developing countries sign up to the Paris Agreement, having therefore the first truly global deal on climate back in 2015, on the basis of this principle of common but differentiated responsibilities. We are all responsible for the planet, for our common house, but our responsibility in taking care of it now differs by our historical contribution to the problem. And of course, rich nations have contributed to the problem way more than many out there in the world. So, the way of turning this principle into practice was a commitment by rich countries to finance, to provide a financial contribution to the poorer countries to undertake mitigation and adaptation projects. And the famous number that circulates every time we have a COP is $100 billion per year. That is the pledge that has been made way before, actually, the Paris Agreement by rich countries. A pledge that was not actually met until recently, because over the last 10 years, the contribution of rich nations has actually been well below what was promised for a long time. Now, we have, in the last years, reached this level, more or less, and the EU plays a very important role here. Why? Because, as we previously mentioned, the EU and its member states are the first providers of climate finance in the order of almost $25 billion in 2022, compared to around 7 and around 4 in respectively Japan and the United States, second and third. So by far, Europe is the first provider of this. Now, the question here is how to ensure that we increase our contribution further, we, Europe and other rich nations. And for that, we have also seen new facilities, new initiatives being undertaken, such as the JETPs, the Just Energy Transition Partnerships, which want to basically develop a new architecture, a new geometry of cooperation with poorer countries or countries in the emerging economies world, in which basically G7 countries put forward some funding in exchange of a clear roadmap to phase out coal, for example. And we have a number of these JETPs now being undertaken with South Africa, Vietnam, and many others. And this is an attempt to go more granular into relationship with individual countries. And at Bruegel, Jeremy Zettelmeyer and other colleagues have been working extensively on how to make these JETPs working better. Now, the question that we are tackling, for example, in this paper is slightly different from the amounts, how to mobilize multilateral development banks and others to get more money when it comes to climate finance. It's really how to spend it. And that's, I think, the key question, right? Because there is a general understanding that most of these investments will have to happen from the private sector. So the question is how to leverage the private sector. And of course, Europe is not China. We cannot push our companies to go into certain African countries and do investments in renewable energy or green steel, for example. So it's all about putting in place the incentives, de-risking tools to do that, but also to work on the demand side. So offtake agreements, etc., are instruments that we think will have to be increasingly utilized to secure the demand for these commodities or potentially also technologies. And this, I think, links very nicely with one of the most fascinating questions when it comes to the interplay of the energy transition and industrialization, which is how will the industrial map change accordingly the new energy map? And we know that with renewable energy, there will be different comparative advantages in the future vis-a-vis the past. In the past, namely, energy-intensive industries were in Europe and globally located closer to the availability of cheap energy sources spanning from coal to hydro. In the future, the cheap energy resource is going to be the sun, the wind, solar irradiation and wind speeds, etc., play a very important role together with land availability. So, for example, as in Europe, we see the potential for industrial relocation, potentially in Spain that has the greater solar irradiation combined with land availability, we might see great comparative advantages in a number of African countries when it comes, for example, to the processing of raw materials, but also really the manufacturing of at least certain stages of products that can then be imported into Europe for the final process of the manufacturing. So the idea of how do we build these green industrial partnerships with third countries, and namely in Africa, it's to us very important, because this also responds to the a bit the cliche, or let's say the buzzword of how the EU can increase its value creation in the global south, which boils really down to, are we able to mobilize investment so that we build factories in these countries that are really then linked into our supply chains? That's a very complex question, of course. It resembles to me what we have done over the last 20 years in renewable energy investments. If I recall the early investments of the European Investment Bank in Morocco, for example, to prove that solar was viable back then. I think now the question is, how do we do this for other things, such as green steel, aluminum, and so on and so forth, ammonia? There are many sectors that are interested by this. And the fact that energy prices in Europe are higher than before the crisis, likely to stay higher in comparison to other world regions as we move forward, will, I think, put forward more pressure to move in this direction, which of course is politically difficult in Europe because it talks about relocation of industries, but at the same time, if well engineered, it might get a higher value-added production in Europe as well.
So, Jacob, this is a tough assignment. You've got all of these existing agreements, which Simone and colleagues in Cecilia are saying need to be consolidated so that they can have better governance and they can work better. You have specific countries with specific relationships with the EU and with its measures. I'm thinking of Mozambique, which has a single industry, as I understand, and is going to be hit very hard by the CBAM. And then you have only so many dollars and so many euros. And it seems like whenever something transformative like this comes up, people want to spend it in their heads five times the amount of money they actually have to push out the door. So where do you go from here?
Well, I mean, you hear terms used like strategy, engineering, that implies that we will have the wisdom and the tools available to us to really kind of shape this world in a way that I think that in the past we've relied more heavily on market forces to do on our behalf. And I think that is the challenge that is increasingly confronting us. You know, are we clever enough? Do we have all the tools available to enable us to do this? Or are we going to continue to have to experiment and innovate before we get things as close to right as possible? And I think that some of the tools that we've been rolling out so far, such as the carbon border adjustment mechanism that's already been described, show how relatively easy it is to articulate and justify a policy on paper as compared to implementing it in practice. All of these measures and these trade and investment engineering that we're anticipating happening in the future rely upon many things, but first and foremost, good data, good information, the ability to plan, the ability to predict how and where and in what form the innovation that we're trying to drive will appear to produce new products, new supply chains, new outcomes. And to me, that suggests that we have to build in to these policies a higher degree of dynamism, a higher degree of experimentation that allows us to recalibrate as we seek certain goals, but then experience barriers to achieving those goals, unintended results, et cetera. And as a diplomat, that's the part of all of this that I am most interested in. How can I make sure that as we are entering this brave new world, that we are in fact creating the right conditions for those trusted partnerships that will not view our policies as a neo-colonialist effort to bring European altruism in its own interests upon the rest of the world. And to me, it really is about making sure that we're having regular, deep conversations with our partners about how we can shape this brave new world together, how we're providing them the capacity that they need to understand and to co-design and to co-implement these plans that we have in mind. The Just Energy Transition Partnerships are an example of that. They're still very, very new in terms of our ability to roll them out, to raise the level of resources necessary to make a difference, to co-design with another major economy. Their energy transition is something that I don't think that we've ever seen tried before in the way that we're trying to do it, for example, in helping a South Africa or an Indonesia to transition away from a heavy dependence on coal to a renewables-based economy. So it's going to be a very dynamic space. I think we need to approach it with a great deal of humility and modesty, obviously driven by that categorical imperative to avoid dangerous climate change and to get to net zero as quickly as possible. But it needs some guardrails and some boundaries around them. Humility and experimentation are one of them. I think the other set of guardrails that we have to build, maintain, and to continue to refine are what we refer to as the multilateral rules-based system. A lot of what we've been able to achieve in terms of lifting people out of poverty and growing economies around the world has been based upon the international trade rules that were essentially designed in the late 1940s and then redesigned in the early 1990s. And they weren't designed to equip with this particular challenge of the transition to net zero. And I think what we're seeing as not just the EU, but other economies, other major economies, the US, the Inflation Reduction Act was mentioned, China, their very muscular industrial policies that are also betting on being front runners and winners in the transition away from fossil fuels, that many new policies are being put in place that don't have those disciplines in mind in the same way that they were originally designed. I think it's absolutely critical for us that as frictions begin to evolve in this space, as the new policies confront the old rules, that we don't abandon those institutions, but rather work together on making sure that we are essentially bending those rules towards these new challenges and making sure that we still have a degree of rule-based system that provides predictability and a sense of fairness that purely strategic autonomy doesn't anticipate.
Cecilia, what do you see as the big political risks in the second half of this year?
I would say that, so in the second part of the year, we will have COP29, which is going to take place in Baku, in Azerbaijan, and we had already a flavor of what is going to happen there. We talked about climate finance. There are going to be even deeper tension about climate finance and probably even, let's say, a wider gap between what are the developed countries and the developing countries that are, of course, asking for a lot of financial support in the order of trillions. And on the other side, you have developed countries that instead are asking for more, let's say, support and increased efforts also from those emerging countries that used to be, again, developing and now might have the firepower that is needed to contribute. So I would say that this is one of the biggest that overall might undermine entire, exactly as we saw last year, they might undermine entire, I want to say, COP process, especially in light of what is going to happen in next year, so COP25, which is particularly relevant and important for the update of the national determined contributions. This is extremely important because we want to have as cohesiveness and trust and mutual trust as possible. And then on the other side, there is, instead, if you look inward, if we have that the domestic delivery, so in Europe, domestic delivery of the European transition is somewhat hampered because of a decreased momentum or because very simply the political winds in Europe are going, you know, straying away from implementation and away from the green agenda, then this is, of course, is going to affect the credibility and legitimacy of the entire European, let's say, effort on the global stage. Is not going to go down well, for sure.
Thanks. In the last section of our podcast, we'll look a little bit more at future challenges and how the career diplomats will find a through line through all of the changes that may be on the horizon. Jacob, you've got a new commission leadership coming in and some major global events, an election coming up in the U.S., budget talks at the EU, the COP conferences, of course, the United Nations climate conferences. How do you keep things moving? And are you able to share with us some of the risks that you will need a plan to deal with without prejudging any outcomes?
Well, I mean, we are in search of stability, right? So what provides stability in this context? I've already mentioned these themes before, but the first and foremost is the concept of net zero. I mean, it's a pretty inescapable categorical imperative, right? We have to get greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by the middle of the century if we're going to avoid most dangerous climate change. And hopefully that will continue to be the categorical imperative for the majority of the globe's emitters. It seems to have held an imperative as a result of the parliamentary elections that just happened within Europe. In the debates that were had pre-election, all the major political parties acknowledged the importance of climate change and EU leadership in that space. And the center essentially held in those elections. And as a result of that, we, as I said before, expect leadership to remain pretty stable and committed to that goal. What else will enable us to maintain stability in a context of change? Well, hopefully the law, the Paris Agreement, obviously, but also in those jurisdictions that have made a legal commitment to get to net zero, like the EU has, that will carry us through as well. I think the lived experience of climate change, as people refer to it, in late June, one of the hottest days that we've experienced this year in Brussels, and our colleagues in the Global South are experiencing absolutely horrible conditions as a result of the average temperature rise in their countries. That's now inescapable. And so hopefully that also will provide, ironically, a degree of stability in terms of the commitment to climate as well. I don't know if you want me to speculate on the outcome of the U.S. election.
Any contingency planning or just, I mean, it's not that I want you to say what will happen depending on which candidate wins. And again, we can condense this question, but more, how does the EU position itself given the volatility out of the US? We don't know who the president will be next year. We don't know how the Congress will be set up. We can probably expect quite a lot of congressional gridlock, even when the U.S. does want to continue with its policies, which it may choose to make a change. That's a hard environment to pursue stability in.
It is. And the only thing I can say that makes us better off this time in terms of a dramatic 180 degree in the U.S. position on climate change is that we've been through it once before and we survived it reasonably well. We have been able to diversify the partnerships that the EU has in a geopolitical context. We, in some circumstances, work very closely, certainly with the most vulnerable progressive countries around the world, the small island states and least developed countries. We have very strong ties in certain areas with even our biggest competitors like China. We work extremely closely with China on carbon markets and carbon pricing. They have learned a lot from our own experience in implementing the ETS when designing what will soon be a nationwide cap and trade system in China as well. We're working very closely with India on trying to imagine what a global supply chain for green hydrogen will look like. The partnerships that we have with South Africa and looking at them as a source of renewable electricity and potentially green hydrogen as well have already been described. So we've diversified our geopolitical relationships as well and hope that those will also maintain a kind of bridge to what might then be a next administration if things go 180 degrees in the U.S. attitude towards climate change. So that will be our hope for stability again. Of course, the challenge is that the closer that you get to mid-century, the more time matters. And it will be extremely difficult if the economic and political signals about climate change in a major economy like the United States basically go 180 degrees for another four-year period in this pathway to net zero and revive interests in maintaining fossil fuels as the base of our economy for a longer period of time. People compared this to a large cargo ship being steered in a particular direction. If it's taken off course, it's very difficult to adjust it back again. So some optimism that we'll be able to survive it, but a deep concern about time that might be lost in the interim.
Simone, what about European gridlock? The new parliament at the EU level is going to have some very large competing factions. The incoming commission may have power centers that are less cooperative than you might want for a joint policy. What if the EU budget gets stuck? What if there's deadlock? Well, then what?
Well, I think that the result of the European elections could have been much worse for the EU climate agenda. I think the Green Deal is not at risk of being dismantled. I think that it has been very difficult to pass all the legislation that we have passed over the last 5 years, and it will be, first of all, very difficult to reverse that. But secondly, I don't expect the new majority in the parliament to have the political willingness of doing that. I think the risk might be there for certain specific elements, like, for example, the ban on internal combustion engine cars for 2035, when we will have to revise these files with the revision clauses, but mainly because these have become a sort of totem that many would like to dismantle just for the sake of showing that the hard right is not the only one understanding a certain discontent in society about specific climate policies. But overall, I think that the structure will remain. What I'm more concerned about is the inaction at the national level, the procrastination at the national level, the lack of implementation. And that's where it will be very important for the EU to have not only the sticks, but also the carrots to get member states move where they need to move in order to get things done. Let's remember that over the next 5 years, we will ask countries to accelerate even by a factor of four the decarbonization of road transport, buildings, and we need to ensure that even after the end of Next Generation EU, the provision of EU green grants will remain, also because that is very important for member states to increase or to sustain their own national funding to the transition, so to leverage private investments. Let's remember that fiscal rules are back. The fiscal space is being shrinking, also because there are other priorities, starting with defense. So we need to avoid a sort of perfect storm where we need the countries to do more, but then we don't have EU money sufficiently and enough to steer progress. If I'm allowed to say one other thing, is one of the risks ahead when it comes to the green transition globally that I see is really the one of protectionism. I think it's extremely important to remember that it is thanks to the open trade economy we had over the last decades that major achievements have been done in the space, for example, of renewable energy. We wouldn't have today the competitive solar PV we have if not due to a mix, not planned necessarily, but spontaneous, of innovation in the U.S., market, and demand construction in Europe, thanks to very generous subsidies, and the manufacturing scale up in China. So this interaction between the three made it possible, one way or the other, to slash costs by achieving economies of scale. Now, if we go down the road of protectionism, with trade wars on solar panels, electric cars, and all the other technologies we need for the transition, that will increase the cost of this transition globally, also and particularly at the expense of those developing countries that can already today hardly afford these technologies. So avoiding a trade war in this space is of existential importance. And that's where I think the EU can have a space to try to foster a plurilateral agreement on subsidies and tariffs when it comes to clean technologies. It's very difficult to be done at the WTO level because we know the United States are not willing to engage at the WTO on this space, but having a plurilateral agreement on green subsidies and tariffs, starting to engage in this conversation with the US and China by the EU would be, I think, extremely important. Really, the provision of one of the possibly most important global public goods in this space.
Cecilia, do you worry that we're headed for a zero-sum game where either people see themselves as competitive or they see themselves as helping the green transition, but they see these as trade-offs rather than things that are the same?
I would say so, actually. I would say that what Jacob has mentioned as one of the, let's say, factors of stability for, let's say, the climate agenda, so the lived experience of climate, might instead at the least individual level hamper support for at least international cooperation in this regard. Very simply because in times of crisis, there is a tendency of looking inward and going, you know, have every country going for themselves. We saw that during the energy crisis, exactly what happened, and it took a lot of effort from the European Union to actually coordinate, let's say, the strategy of the individual member states. And then we saw the United States going their own way, for example. I think what Simon has just highlighted, that the European Union should strive, should look away as much as possible from protectionism, is something that European policymakers should have very much in mind, just because I see that as a real risk, a tangible risk. But that would, first of all, hamper any consideration of climate justice or any commitment to international cooperation and multilateralism, as Jacob was saying. But then also would not really serve the interests of the European Union. For example, this deal on green subsidies, for example, would definitely serve directly also the need for development of our own manufacturing industry, but also we need to look away from protectionism in order to restructure our green supply chains in a way that can, again, leverage the, a more beneficial environment in third countries. And we can only do that when these agreements and partnerships are perceived as being really fair with all the parties involved. So I do say it as a risk, but I'm hopeful that we can do better than just fall into a trap.
What do you think, Jacob?
I think you need an entire other podcast that is dedicated to understanding what the difference between policies that are there to ensure the continued competitiveness of a country that or a region that wants to decarbonize without deindustrializing, so competitiveness concerns, and one that isn't at the same time protectionist. Because when I talk about the need to maintain a multilateral rule-based system, but one that is fit for the purpose of getting us to net zero in a way that is seen as something that brings prosperity to regions like the EU, but also to countries like China and Morocco and India and South Africa, it does need a retooling of those rules so that when we say protectionist, we know what we're talking about when we say protectionist. So our domestic content requirements, which have been absolutely essential for political support in the U.S. for the Inflation Reduction Act, are they considered protectionist, or are they a legitimate way of ensuring that when you're investing your taxpayer money into promoting innovation, that it's not unintentionally subsidizing the industry of a third country that you're competing with? You know, when we say that we want to adjust at the border with regard to CBAM in order to ensure that we're not creating carbon leakage and that we're maintaining our own industrial base, is that legitimate or is that protectionist? When we say that we want to engineer supply chains that ensure that our poorest partners benefit from the green economy and that that market isn't immediately consumed by a third country that already has comparative advantage in this space, is that protectionist or is that a fair and appropriate development strategy? So these are all really interesting questions that I think involve the engagement of economists as well as diplomats, but probably require some time to go deeper on.
Jacob Werksman, joining us today, Principal Advisor to the European Commission and leading a lot of the international diplomacy on these issues. Thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you. Also on this podcast, you've heard Cecilia Trazzi and Simone Tagliapietra. They are the authors of a new report that you can find on Bruegel's website. And there's an event, a launch event, also with the three speakers you've heard today and a couple others, Anthony Agatha from the European External Action Service and Norbert Horissen from the German Foreign Office. The report and the event are both called Re-energizing Europe's Global Green Reach. You can find these and the recordings of this and other podcasts on our website, Bruegel.org. If you're interested in these questions of competitiveness and protectionism, I have to plug a couple of other podcasts we've had recently. We did one with Penny Nass from the German Marshall Fund and Bruegel's Nicolas Poitier, specifically about the Washington, Brussels, Beijing attempt to balance these issues. And our own Yuyun Jun has done one with our China team on the car tariff specifically. You can find all of this on Bruegel.org, on the Sound of Economics, on all of your podcast channels. And we thank you so much for your time and for listening. Thanks. Have a great day. See you next time.